Chapter 13. Epilogue. February, 1818. Childemas made sure to be in Yorkshire for mid-February. He held no real hope, but the part of him that had listened to the tales of wandering magicians as a child had latched onto a year and a day without any conscious effort on his part. Whether he believed it or not was a different matter. That said, the accuracy of his hunches was something he took a little pride in, so he saddled Brewer early on the 10th and began his ride north, apologizing to the mayor of a small town in Gloucestershire for cutting his business short and promising to write a solution after consulting his colleagues before taking once more to the road. Aside from any hunches he might have had, he had surprised himself a little at being pleased by the excuse to return to the north. His pace had been steady, the February weather cold and gray and drizzling. He had traveled in worse, there was no bright sunshine to dazzle his eyes, nor any biblical downpour to turn the roads to a quagmire, which was all he would hope for. The drizzle would soak, but the brim of his hat would keep it from his eyes, and the road was not so muddy as to stall their progress. His coat had seen him through many winter rides, and would see him through many more. Brewer was steadfast and uncomplaining as always, happy as long as he was given a clean stall and fresh hay at the end of the day. As with so many journeys, he kept his nightly stops to the roadside inns. He enjoyed them at this time of year, not so full of the high-born few stopping on their way from one grand party to another, the air less saturated with their braying voices and sniffing displeasure. Instead, the taprooms and firesides were crowded with people of purpose, men and women gathered together to warm themselves in comfort and solidarity after a day of hard labor, allowing themselves the laughter and storytelling such cold, damp nights necessitated. Childemas joined in, listening to the stories and telling some of his own. Childemas had many stories. Listening intently to those who spoke or sang, and watching intently those who did neither. Magicians valued books above rubies, but books were only words given physical form. Words began in the minds and on the tongues of men. They grew from somewhere far older than ink and paper, charcoal and birch bark, stylus and clay. Books were useful, yes, and he coveted and hunted them himself. They stabilized the words and made them fast, so they could not be forgotten by the fallible minds of men, but in fixing them so, they lost the magic of change, the importance of malleability. That was the failing of modern magicians, he thought, as he smoked his pipe and listened to an old shepherd sing the story of long-ago drowned children. The words they read were fixed, so their ideas were fixed. They did not know about the circumstances of magic, of the roughness of it, how a particular spell had to be cast in new and different forms each time, how it had to be bent and molded to each situation. No two ash trees grew to be identical. They reflected their own patch of soil and their own ration of sunlight. They twisted round or hunkered under the brambles and ivy which may grow around them. Why should a spell be any different? There were magicians who thought differently, he knew. Norrell had known it once, but had been too keen to cement his own words as the only way, and had fallen into that same ossifying trap as the books he hoarded. Strange had known it, once he had found his way out from under Norrell's gaze. Childemas had seen the difference in him when he had returned from the peninsula, brown-faced and older around the eyes. Childemas himself knew it, had always known it, no matter how steadfastly Norrell had clung to his books and his stone-firm ideas. Magic had, after all, wound its way into Childemas's heart and mind as a child, growing like bindweed years before he taught himself to read, now blooming its loud trumpet bell flowers in his chest. Segundus knew it too, and that had taken him rather aback. That moment before Lady Pole, when Childemas had seen him reach with instinct rather than thought for spoon and bodkin, and Childemas had felt his own regard for the man, which had been growing slowly, steadily, ever since that dark, snow-shrouded morning in York. Swell. They had never discussed it, but Childemas often watched Segundus's face as they performed magic, noticed the barely perceptible pause as he thought, only for half a moment, and adjusted a spell minutely to better fit the atmosphere, just as he moved the plants in the Staircross garden to a place where the lighter soil might better suit them. Childemas had spent too many minutes to count, watching the way Segundus's eyes would catch on a flock of birds, on a drift of leaves, on the water in a brook, watching the way his brows would pull together in a frown of concentration, in the same way they did when he hunched over Vinculus's skin. Books, for Segundus, were a starting point, a useful tool. They were not the be-all, end-all they were for those like Norrell, like Fox Castle, like every other subscriber to the newspapers and periodicals. Segundus was glad for the magicians of the past, was gleeful, even, to read their work. Childemas remembered well the open look of wonder the man had worn when he set eyes on the Hertfew Library, had seen the spark of possibility in him. But he knew that one magician from 300 years ago could not hold every answer. Segunda saw them for what they were, the thoughts of men and women set down, there to be investigated and evaluated and picked at, until the bones of them were clean, all that was useful to be salvaged and repurposed to form something new, that might do the job better in this new world they had seen born, that they had helped deliver. It was not new, the way his thoughts turned to Segundus when he had the rare opportunity to let his mind wander, although it was happening with an increasing regularity. He had spent some time, a decade past, thinking over that glint of wonder in the dim wintry light of the library, of the bright, suspicious expression standing fast against his own silence that snowy morning the world had changed for them all. The shiver of great magic still in the air, as he wondered what lay behind a man with such clear and simple curiosity. Time hadn't faded those images as it had others. Subsequent meetings had not wiped away those initial conceptions he had of Segundus's character. Yet still he found himself continually surprised. The fire burned in his room, his own for the first time this journey, the inn quiet enough to allow him a small room with a small bed, but there was a fireplace and a quilt, and that was all he needed. Tomorrow he would reach York, the day after he would be home. It was a thought that washed casually through him, but a moment later made him sit up and examine it. It was a strange thought for him. Home. Almost discomforting in the ease with which it had come to him. He had never held much to the concept, had never had enough of one as a child for it to stick. Part of it was, of course, what had always driven him, magic, the study and discussion of it. Again, he saw that glowing wonder of Segundus's as he gazed around the library, so many years distant but still so bright in his memory. Magic would still be part of it, even if there were nothing more, and were that the case, Childermas would still be content to sit by the fire in that small, warm library for the sake of Segundus's keen and kind intellect, hollow as it may make his heart feel. That dull ache would be a small price to pay for such companionship. But something more did await, and Childermas was as glad of it as he was taken aback by it. The feeling, when he had first noticed the stirrings of it, was more inconvenient than anything else. But to know now, so many years later, that some of that kindness, some of that warmth, was his and his alone, was enough to tempt him to the King's Roads to make swifter his return. It made the wanting that much keener, knowing what awaited him. He felt, in this dark, lonely inn, filled with the muffled sounds of strangers' lives, like a starving man who has scavenged a scrap from the King's table, something hot and rich and delicious. But who knows, it will be days before he can be properly sated. The thought of the feast to come was comfort enough for him, and he fell asleep, thinking of the touch of John Segundus's kiss. The next evening, he stopped at York in time for dusk. He had business to attend to and people to see in the city after all, and in the morning found himself passing the cathedral as dawn broke, the great soaring facade glowing softly in the overcast February light. An urge gripped him, seizing him by the shoulders and pressing him to enter. Having no reason not to, he did. Childermas was not a man of any great faith. He knew his own heart and knew where its allegiances lay. There was something about these monuments, however, that conjured wonder in even the skeptic's heart. It was nothing to do with the Holy Ghost, but the determination of men, their capabilities and their vision to create something magnificent. He thought again of Norrell, of the days of discussion they had gone through to choose the arena for his display. Childermas had not been sure his master would approve the plan, that the part of him that yearned for respectability would refuse it as heretical, but he had agreed, somewhat to Childermas's surprise. He thought now of that cold, dark morning, of the hunched and frightened figures of the York Society skittering around the cathedral like dead leaves in a gale as the stones scraped out their stories like centuries of dust. He thought of Segundus, a decade ago, standing on those steps and telling him no. He thought of Segundus in this great echoing nave, looking around him in wonder and awe. He thought of Segundus as he would be now, sleep-rumpled and waking and within a day's ride. The inn was close, and with the ease and swiftness of long practice, he saddled Brewer and took to the road. The ride to Staircross was neither leisurely nor hurried. The landscape did not blur past him as it had a year ago when his cheek had felt cold with blood and his mind disordered with something he could still not quite remember, but he did not slow to admire it. He knew his destination, and he kept his eyes ahead. Brewer knew, too, and followed the direct route. The February day was kind to them. It was colder in Yorkshire than it had been in Gloucestershire, but drier. He did not mind the rain, but, he thought with a smile, Segundus might object to being pressed against the wall by a man with wet arms and thighs. The thought kept him warm as the thin layer of cloud peeled away to let the thin sun spill over the moors, 1,000 little puddles and rivulets glinting palely before him, as though they were lighting the way to the other lands. It was late when he reached Staircross, the last exhausted rays of the weak sun clinging onto the gray stones of the building, but the increasingly crisp air was caught and warmed in the stables, and the time spent on saddling Brewer and brushing him down also worked to get some blood back to his own hands and feet as he listened to Davy's happy gossip with half an ear. The school was full and busy, the cheer and bustle audible even from here. His bags felt heavier than they had in York as he picked them up to carry them into the hall, his eyes gritty with fatigue. Now that he had arrived, the week of travel had settled on him like dust from the road. Not wanting the attention of the household, he slipped in the back door and through the kitchen, shrouding himself in a little light shadow to avoid Mrs. White catching him in her endless conversation, although he saw her shiver and cast over her shoulder with a frown, telling Dido off for leaving the door ajar on such a cold evening. Inside, the school was full of more than just the teachers and students. The anniversary had brought a host of guests, and Childermouse was content to avoid them for now, travel-weary and road-grimed as he was. He paused in the back corridor and peeked through to the main hall to examine the cheerful congregation. As well as the students, who seemed in a great excitement, Lady Pole and Arabella Strange sat together by the fire, and gathered around the harpsichord were more honey-feet than Childermouse had ever seen in one place. By the window sat Vinculus with a group of wide-eyed boys around him. Childermouse dreaded to think what his tale involved. He propped himself against a wall and let himself watch, unnoticed. He was glad for the people filling the house, for the bright conversation bubbling up, for the light music provided by one of Mr. Honeyfoot's daughters, who was acquiring rather a circle of students around her. It contrasted with the Staircross of a year ago, dripping with enchantment and isolation. He could still see Segundus, the huge, dark house and empty labyrinth around him. He smiled to himself a little as he watched the crowd, but there was a sharp, bitter taste pooling at the corners of his jaw. He watched Lady Pole and Mrs. Strange more closely than the others and could see the air of festivity had not infected them. They spoke little to each other, but their looks communicated more than words perhaps could over the cheer. Mrs. Strange swallowed deeply and looked up, seeming to look straight through his shadows and through him, too. He stayed still and silent, meeting her eyes. She had lost more than anyone a year ago. Her husband and her home, her possessions and her memories. She herself stranded a continent away and unable to do anything but mourn. He felt the loss of Hurtview in a sudden pang, the foundations he had been building on top of the hollow it had left in him crumbling like a subsiding cliff. He swallowed and nodded his head, unsure if she could see him or if she just happened to be looking in his direction. He wondered again at his certainty, felt it slip. A year and a day did not seem the correct price to pay for the changes wrought. What were the other common contracts? 100 years? 1,000? What was the return of English magic worth? Davy said you had arrived. The voice came from behind him, soft so as not to be heard by the rest of the party. Childermouse turned to look. I wondered why I did not hear you announced. I should have known you would be lurking somewhere looking disreputable. I always look disreputable. Answered Childermouse, a smile jerking across his mouth at the sight of Segundus's own, disrupting his melancholy thoughts. Sometimes more than others. Segundus glanced around quickly and reached forward to squeeze Childermouse's hand. Come to my study, I've something to show you before dinner. Childermouse gave him a slow nod and gripped his hand tightly before Segundus went into the room. Mr. Honeyfoot let out a cry of, Mr. Segundus! And beckoned him over to solve an argument. Childermouse slipped back through to the kitchen and went up the back stairs. Knowing Segundus would be a while delayed by Honeyfoot, he stopped Charles on the stairs and asked for some warm water in his room to freshen himself up after his journey. He scrubbed himself clean, sorted his cue, and changed his clothes for some he had not spent 5 days on a horse in. He felt almost immediately brighter, and when he got to Segundus's study, found it uninhabited. The room was positioned in the southern part of the house so as to catch as much light throughout the day as possible. The sun was on its way to setting now, casting a black and orange lattice over all the accoutrements of a magician's study. Childermouse waved his hand across a candle on the desk, lighting it with a thought. It was such a simple use for magic that he would have shied away from using it a year ago, worried that this flood of magic through England would eventually ebb and dry up. He would never have thought of using it for something so wasteful. The study, illuminated by candle and by setting sun, was a sight that was familiar to Childermouse, in the general if not the details. He let his eyes rove over the space, noticing the small changes that had accumulated over the last few weeks. Segundus had acquired a small pair of curtains, which now hung either side of the large mirror above the fireplace, a precaution Childermas had been meaning to advise him of, but was impressed to see acted upon independently, and a small vase of snowdrops sat on the desk, one bloom lying dissected upon a wooden board before the seat, its petals scattered and its stalk now a cross-section of itself. Beside the ruin lay a copy of Oakford's The Uses and Aspects of Flowers, open at a paragraph detailing the anatomy of the snowdrop and the magical uses of each organ. Childermas leaned in to read the notes Segundus had jotted in his memorandum book in the dying afternoon light. I wondered if it might be possible to apply them to some spell of purification. He had heard Segundus's careful footsteps coming closer, so was not surprised at the sound of his voice.
You don't set much stock by Oakford, I see.
Childermas looked over his shoulder with a wry smile and saw Segundus's face twist in distaste.
I find he is over-concerned with fertility. One cannot read a paragraph without some mention.
Segundus closed the door and moved to sit in the chair on the far side of the desk with a sigh. Although it no doubt plays a part, it does become tiring when other possibilities are passed over in favor of it.
And how is your research on purification coming? Childermas asked, slipping into the chair which by all means should have been Segundus's.
Oh, fairly well, he answered. I think there may be some application for the purification of the mind. Oh, do not give me that look. He laughed, as Childermas could not hold back a smirk. I mean, with the particular form of lunacy which shows itself in old age. I am working on a spell which I hope will purify the memory of afflicted persons and return them to their usual selves. There is a lady in the village, Mrs. Gowers, who I think could improve by it.
That is a fine use for magic, Childermas said.
The enthusiasm that had danced over Segundus's face as he described his project made Childermas's weariness ease. He settled back in the chair, glad for the padded leather back. Her family approached me. They seem to think I have a special knowledge, having been both a magician and a mad housekeeper. His face compressed into a frown as he raised his hand to swat some invisible thing away from his nose. Anyway, that is all beside the point. This is what I wish to show you. He rose from his chair and picked a book from a shelf. He tucked it under his arm and whisked the remains of the snowdrop away from Childermas, setting the book in its place. Childermas felt the warmth from him as he leaned close to open it to the particular page he needed. Unable to stay his hand, Childermas took a light hold around Segundus's wrist. The contact worked to still the bustle in Segundus, to catch the breath in his throat.
I am keen to hear what you have to say, Childermas said slowly, circling his thumb absently over the delicate skin of Segundus's wrist. But I will be here for days. At this moment, I am just glad to be among friends.
But I am sure I have made a kind of breakthrough. Are you sure you do not?
I am sure.
He pulled Segundus toward him, a gentle tug on his wrist, and drew him onto his lap. Segundus laughed, quietly and lightly, and let himself be settled. The others are downstairs, and the door is unlocked, Segundus warned, but his voice carried a note of humor, and his hands alighted warmly on Childermas's, where they linked together over his belly. Childermas pressed his nose into his neck to inhale the scent of him.
"Worry not," he said, caught between a laugh and a sigh. "I'm a little tired just now to ravish you entirely."
Segundus laughed and leaned back into him.
"Let us just sit a while."
He kissed Segundus's ear, his jaw, and sighed. His eyes closed as he rested his cheek against Segundus's shoulder. Soft lips brushed against his temple, and something in his shoulders unlocked. I have missed you. The hands atop his tightened so slightly that Childermas might have imagined it, but then Segundus slipped his fingers into the gaps between Childermas's own. His weight was warm and solid, and Childermas felt the parts of himself that had become shaken apart during his journey slowly melt together once more under him. He did not say anything in reply. He knew Segundus did not require it of him. He just sat for that peaceful moment, anchored and anchoring, until they heard footsteps coming along the corridor. Segundus kissed him gently on the lips and slipped from his arms, standing just as someone knocked on the door. It was Charles. "Begging pardon, sirs, but dinner will be ready shortly," he said when Segundus had called for him to enter. "And Mrs. Lennox has arrived, Mr. Segundus. We will be right down. Please reassure her." Childermas pushed to his feet with a sigh and an involuntary groan that would not have come from him 10 years earlier.
"Well," he said, stretching his shoulders back and stifling a yawn, Let's get this over with. The evening was merrier than he could have hoped for. The students each stood and took their turn to recite a poem or a portion of a book they had translated from the Latin, all finishing to the sound of applause from the adults. Childermas talked of his adventures since his last visit. He was reluctant to name them as such, but the students seemed determined to view them in that way. His conversation about the deciphering of symbols with Dr. Young, his argument with a lawyer in a village in Derbyshire over accepting the employment of fairies, and his investigation of a barrow in Gloucestershire, which was provoking a great deal of unease in the mayor. This last tale drew the attention of all the students and the adults, some expressions sharper than others, and at their request he explained the precautions he had taken, tying around his wrist a scarlet ribbon and carrying with him a small stone he had found on a beach near Grimsby through which a hole had been bored by the ocean. This stone, he explained, as he held it up for general view, which held in front of the eye and looked through, dispelled any visual illusions placed by enchantment. Thus he had made his way into the barrow through a chink which had lately appeared, protecting himself with Ormskirk's charm to dispel illusion, securing it with his stone and ribbon, and had found the barrow to be nothing out of the ordinary. The opening was, it seemed, due more to the settling of earth caused by some nearby industry than from any supernatural interference. He had realized this on his journey, and reminded himself to write the mayor in reassurance. Segundus thanked him for such an educational tale, and then sent the students off to bed, as it was past 9. As the adults retired to the drawing room, the mood turned quiet and somber. Without the excitable presence of the students, without their youthful naivety to cushion, thoughts and talk turned to what had been lost. Arabella Strange said little, but stared at the fire as Lady Pole talked of Stephen Black. Childermas kept himself quiet. His grief had never been something to be shared. But he watched as Segundus looked to Mrs. Strange, saw the expressions exchanged, and was unsurprised when Segundus began to speak of Strange, of his friendship, his genius, the wonder of his magic. Cut grass and thunder, Childermas remembered, and the heat of a summer's day. Segundus wondered, more quietly and carefully, about the magic they might be doing, Strange and Norrell, in their Tower of Darkness. Childermas thought of Hurtview as it had been, grand and lonely in its grounds, but warm within. He thought of the well-worn flags and warm fires of the servants' hall and kitchen, the cheerful chatter that grew quieter as one moved to the drawing room, to the library. There had been companionship there. There had been a home. What was Hurtview now, trapped in never-ending night, holding only two souls? They were comfortable, Childermas knew. The cards had told him that much, but had been obstinate about saying anything more. Secluded away from the world with nothing but his books and Mr. Strange, Norrell could want for nothing more, Childermas knew. He remembered the Tower of Darkness, shivered a little at the memory. He had come close to joining them, he knew. He stroked absently at the scar on his cheek, a year old now, and looked up from the fire to find Segundus watching him, a line of concern etched between his brows. The look twisted something in him, something deep and warm and visceral. He could not help the smile that crept across his face to be frowned at so, and waved away Segundus's worry. He was only tired, he tried to say with the gesture and the smile, tired and overly given to introspection. This seemed to work, as Segundus inclined his head a little and a moment later turned to Honeyfoot, who was nodding off in fits and starts in his chair, and declared how late it was getting, and they had best retire for the night. With the house so full, Childermas waited in his own bed until all was silent. The floorboards were chill against his bare feet as he trod softly to the dressing room door. In that small, in-between room, he paused and listened. He saw the soft glow of candlelight below the door before he heard the sigh and rustle of bedsheets, and smiled as he eased the second door open and slipped into Segundus's bedchamber. He found Segundus sitting up, spectacles propped on his nose as he read. Those were new. They rendered something different about Segundus, and it took Childermas a moment to realize that he no longer frowned down at his reading as though he were very stubbornly disagreeing with the author, which Childermas realized he would miss, strange as it may be. Segundus, engrossed in his pamphlet, only looked up at the sound of the lock, but glanced over so quickly and with such a surprised expression on his face that Childermas could not help but smile. "John!" Segundus cried, and moved to get out of bed. Childermas held up a hand to stop him, and moved forward himself to climb in. "I hadn't thought to see you tonight, you seemed so tired." "I cannot deny that," Childermas said with a sigh. The journey still hung upon him like lead weights. "But my own bed was cold." He reached forward to rest his hand on the warm skin of Segundus's neck, just where it met his shoulder, where his nightshirt had slipped down. A thought occurred to him, one he did not want to focus on too clearly. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, of course not.
Segundus smiled, a flush rising to his cheeks. I had worried you wouldn't come rather than otherwise. Childemas just smiled and nodded slowly, using the hand on Segundus's neck to pull him closer.
You are happy with me, John?
The question rose to his lips unbidden, seeping from the overfull place in his chest. In a moment, Segundus frowned once more. I only ask, he added, as he could see a number of questions poised to rush forth, because I would like to be sure that you're as happy as I. Joy burst across Segundus's face, like a grouse startled from the moor. Yes, he replied, smiling.
I believe I am.
Childemas leaned across then and kissed him, felt the moment Segundus sighed and melted toward him. He had not expected, a year ago, to have this place to call home. It was not something he had thought to have for himself, this warm, responsive man beside him, twining his fingers in Childemas's hair. Having not expected it, he found himself surprised at each return by the open arms awaiting him, the wonder-filled eyes sparking at the sight of him. Lie back, Segundus said, palm flat against his chest and pushing gently but firmly. Childemas laughed a little at that, couldn't help himself at the sight of the sternness in Segundus's eyes. He acquiesced. As soon as his head met the pillow, he realized how heavy it had become. He sighed, his eyes fluttering shut against his will. Segundus's palm remained on his chest, warm and steady as his own heart. He stretched his legs out under the covers, eased out his aching back. Segundus's fingers slipped under the collar of his nightshirt to rest against his skin, to rub soothing circles over his chest. When Segundus's nails scratched lightly against his skin, they pulled a rumble of satisfaction from him forcibly. This noise seemed to tug Segundus closer to him, to draw his lips to Childemas's, soft and open to the nip of Childemas's teeth. Childemas said, and covered the hand on his chest with his own. I had so much planned for this night. He smiled, loved the feel of Segundus's mouth against it. I thought of little else the entire ride from Tewkesbury. Under his touch, Segundus's fingers flexed, scratching his skin once more. He opened his eyes, a greater effort than he would have wished, and looked up into Segundus's gentle gaze. But I'm afraid my efforts must go to waste. In the candlelight, Segundus's eyelashes seemed to glow as he glanced down to their joined hands. Sleep, he said, and kissed Childemas's frown. Plans do not go to waste, they are merely delayed. He laughed a little, in truth more a smile and a breath than a laugh, and once more met Childemas's gaze. Look at my school, he said, and the smile grew wider, thriving despite my plans being thwarted by sinister men. Childemas closed his eyes once more, unable to keep them open. In the morning I'll show you what sinister men can do. Segundus laughed and kissed him. A moment later, Childemas heard his puff of breath and caught the scent of candle smoke, and then Segundus was lying down, pressed alongside him, their hands still joined and heavy on Childemas's chest. Good night, my love, Segundus said, and kissed the silvery scar on his cheek. The end.